This session was is on Mormon Publishing in the 90s, and I guess both the major speaker and the respondent are both have serious medical problems. And so Greg Coford, who I do not know, will be filling in, but we'll ask him to introduce himself, and we'll make it the run at the subject anyway. And I don't know, we may have a respondent depending on what happens. So, Greg, it's your show, and please introduce yourself. And thanks for filling in.
I'm president of Greg Coford Books. It's a new publishing firm that we've just started this year. My involvement in Mormon books began actually in a serious way when I was at graduate school back at MIT. Boston is the mecca of used bookstores, in my opinion, having traveled around the world. And one day, just out of curiosity, I had some time to kill, and I wandered into a used bookstore, and I thought, oh, I'll see if there's any Mormon stuff. And I'd grown up in a household where the Mormon library consisted of an absolute pristine set of the Comprehensive History of the Church, because nobody had ever read it, but it was like an eighth printing, and Marvelous Work and a Wanderer, Miracle Forgiveness, that kind of stuff. So I'd not really had any exposure to anything unusual or rare or anything, and when I was looking around in this bookstore, I noticed a book that looked about the shape of a Book of Mormon, but it was black leather, and it was missing the top portion of the spine. And I pulled it out, and I looked at it, and indeed, it was a Book of Mormon. It was dated 1903, and in it was a dedication from Joseph F. Smith to Senator Albert Beveridge during the Reed-Smoot hearings. And the book had written in it a price that in pencil was $600. Now, being an idiot, I didn't realize what you do at that stage is you go up, you throw $6 at the guy, and you run out the door before he realizes what's happened. So I'm thinking, well, is this $600? Is it $6? And I really have no idea. So I take it up and I handed it to the proprietor of the bookshop, and I innocently asked, is this book priced correctly? And the guy looks at the price, he looks at the inscription, he looks at the title page with the 1903 date, looks at the inscription again, looks up at me, and he goes, ah, hell, Joe must have been dead by then. This must be some other Joe Smith. How about $4.50? And thus began my odyssey with Mormon books. I became a rather dedicated collector from that juncture. I subsequently got involved in a more professional way in 1990 when I moved back to Utah to take control of Siegel Book and Tapes. At that point in time, it was a little neophyte bookstore, and I built it over the next several years up into a chain of 10 stores, and then kind of got bored and left, and it's continued on to greater success and glory beyond what I did. But my passion for collecting has not died, and I guess that's why I was tapped to try and fill in here. Unfortunately, what has happened is Brian, who was to give the paper, had a problem. He's unable to speak. And the original intent was Kurt Bench, who was to be the respondent, was going to read Brian's paper and then give his response. But Kurt had a medical problem himself yesterday morning. He had to go in for open-heart surgery. He's doing much better today, but needless to say, people have gone to great extremes to avoid giving this paper. So if I get struck by lightning, you'll know there's a reason, kind of a thing. Unfortunately, because of the shortness of time, I don't have any pictures to show you of the books that I'm going to talk about briefly. And then when I kind of run out of things to say, we'll drag Tom Kimball up here. And Tom works for me at Greg Coford Books, and prior to that, he was a buyer at Benchmark Books, so Tom's pretty familiar with the used book arena as well. And if we're sticking just with the 1990s, as Brian had originally talked about, I guess one of the first kind of oddities that popped up was Abraham Gileadi's book that was published by Deseret Book. Deseret Book had been working on this book for a long time, and they put it out, and it was an instant hot bestseller. We couldn't keep them in the Siegel stores. Deseret Book couldn't keep them in. The first print run was practically sold out. They didn't have time to schedule a second print run. And I was back on a junket, for lack of a better word, that Deseret Book took does every year for their better dealers. And I'm back there, and Gary Swap, who's vice president of wholesale of Deseret Book, mentioned that The Last Days, the title of the book by Abraham Gileadi, that they were not going to be able to provide me anymore for the stores. And I was giving him grief the whole time we're on this trip back in Washington, D.C. anyway, because we weren't able to keep it in supply. And the thing that you learn in retailing is if it's not there when the people want to buy it, 9 out of 10 people don't come back and buy it later when it is available. I mean, it's by and large an impulse thing. Well, I kept pushing Gary, to find out what was going on, and I couldn't really get an answer out of him. We get back to Utah, and Gary finally admitted that they had, under pressure from certain authorities, unnamed, Deseret Book had yanked Last Days off of Deseret Book shelves, and they were not going to be reprinting it. I then, of course, why is it yanked? What's going to happen to the books that you've pulled? He told me, I've been instructed to shred them. So being the national entrepreneur I am, what shredder are you going to be using? So we went the rounds on that. We then contacted Abraham Gileadi, and it turns out in his publishing agreement, as is typical in a publishing agreement, including ours, that before the publisher can actually dispose of the books, other than a normal sell, they need to offer them to the author. So we got a hold of Abraham and said, listen, Deseret Book is contractually obligated to offer these books to you. When they offer them to you, take them all. He's like, well, what if there's a lot of them? I said, I don't care, just take them all. What if there's a whole bunch? Take them all. So Deseret Book at this juncture had not even notified him they had pulled his book off the shelves. He then got a call from Ron Millett, who was president and still is president of Deseret Book, and Ron informed him that unfortunately they'd found it necessary to pull his book, that they had about 1,300 copies that they had still had in the warehouse. Ron said he just felt a moral obligation to offer them to Abraham, but he played a bit of a gambit there, and he told Abraham, you'll have to take all of them, or I really don't want to give you any of them. Gambling that, your typical author doesn't have $13,000, $14,000 sitting around on a moment's notice to buy his own book. Well, Abraham, of course, due to my prompting, said, okay, I'll take them all. He later said that was the longest pause he's ever heard in a phone conversation. We were able to get Peggy Stack interested in the story. Ron told Abraham the books would be available the next morning. We went over to the warehouse, picked them up. As the story was broken on the front page of the Salt Lake Tribune, the book had been yanked from Deseret Book. We had them out in the stores. Took us 2 days to sell through them, kind of a thing. So that book was subsequently picked up by my father's company, Covenant Communications. They put it back into print. It sold strongly, and then when it slowed down a bit, then Abraham took it back, and it's still in print. Interestingly enough, you can buy that book now in Deseret Book again. So that's example one. Another fun experience we had was the church went to great efforts to do a new Spanish translation of the Book of Mormon. That took, over a decade, huge committees, dozens of translators working on it, and then people comparing the translations to try and put it into a more readable form of the Book of Mormon. And they went through and completed the complete translation. It has all of the new chapter headings, the footnotes, etc., that, those of us who use the English version have been able to enjoy since 1978. Well, they finally did that for the Spanish-speaking people. The book was finished and approved in its translational form. If I recall, it was approved at the end of 91, and they actually put it into print in 1992. And what they had done is they had basically stopped printing the Book of Mormon once it looked like this new translation was getting close. So the Spanish-speaking people, the missions in South America, etc., kind of went through a famine for a brief period of time until they were ready to ship this new edition out. I've been over to the church printing center. I've been up to the scripture committee offices trying to verify what the number is they did in that first printing. And depending on the source, they either did an initial printing of 500,000 copies or of 1,000,000 copies of that book. We ordered at Siegel, we ordered in a fairly large quantity because we had a store in Los Angeles, as well as a modest business here in Utah selling, as well as in Arizona, selling Spanish language materials. So we ordered a modest quantity. The day after we picked those up from the distribution center, we got a rather anxious call from the distribution center wanting to know if they could come and pick up those Book of Mormons. I told them that just coincidentally we had sold them all, we didn't have any to give that back. I really felt bad. Was there a reason why they wanted them back? The person on the phone asking for them back really didn't have an answer, said they'll just get back to us. We subsequently got a letter from Church Distribution explaining that there was a slight typographical error in one of the chapter headings. It was in Moroni chapter 3. In English, it talks about the priesthood as administered by the laying on of hands. Now, the Spanish word for hands is manos, M-A-N-O-S. In the typesetting of this process that took 10 years, it's, you know, gone through numerous reviews, numerous copy checking, etc., somehow the M was dropped off of that, anos. Now, in correct Spanish, that has no meaning. In guttural Spanish, it means asshole. And they put out a mere either 500,000 or 1,000,000 copies. They then distributed to us some stickers, asked us, you know, to provide those to any of our patrons who did not want to return the book, and then they turn around and shred all the copies they had and immediately put out a corrected version. That Anos version of the Book of Mormon, which is similar for people who collect Bibles. There's a rather infamous adulterer's Bible where in the Ten Commandments it reads, "Thou shalt commit adultery." And that edition of the Bible commands quite a premium. Well, this is about as close as we've got in Mormondom to something like that. That book is extremely rare. Other than the copies that I had and a few others, you know, I just don't know of many that survived or made it through that process. It's one of those quirks kind of a thing. Another set that's kind of fun is President Benson mentioned to some people at the church office building that he would like to have an exemplar copy of each language that the Book of Mormon was published in. That then turned into a full-blown project of the display department, the printing division, and the historian's office. And what they did is they took a first edition of Danish, German, Italian, French, Swedish, Welsh, and Japanese, and they made facsimile reproductions of those. They printed less than 100 copies of each of those. They provided a set to each of the various visitor senators that were interested in having one. Quorum of the Twelve got a set, Historian's Office got a set, and there were a select few people within the Historian's Office that received a set. Where the humor comes into that, other than the $80,000 to $100,000 expense of producing the set, is that when the set was proudly presented to President Benson to put on his bookshelf, he was rumored to have responded, "I was just talking about the $2 blue ones you get at church distribution." So that set, needless to say, is very obscure. It's not restricted. I mean, if you want to see a set, You can go to the historian's office. It's in the computer. You can call it down. They'll show it to you. There's also a set on the coffee table up on, if I remember correctly, it's the 14th floor where the scripture committee is. You go in their little entranceway, and they've got a set there on a coffee table or postum table or whatever it's called in the church office building. Conveniently sitting there right next to a window getting sun bleached. So in another, you know, 3-4 years, you know, it'll be pretty much totally wrecked. There's also a set that is a little harder to get to, but I've seen that. It's in the conference center or the conference room in the church printing center out by the church distribution center out just off of I-215 and Redwood Road, kind of a thing. They've got one in their conference room. It's all under lock and key and glass case, kind of a thing. To my knowledge, there's only been a single set of that actually come into the collector's arena, and I think that was one that Brian, were he here, would have probably showed you a picture of, because Brian is now the owner of that set, having acquired it through Kurt Bench's shop. Kurt managed to get that from a lucky recipient, and Brian was the collector who ended up with it, and I speak of that very enviously. That's a set I would really like to have, kind of a thing. So you've got a lot of fun and rather obscure things that the church is producing. You also have things that are being produced by, you know, the more commercial producers, kind of a thing. So maybe what I'll do is I'll give Tom a chance to come up, and he can tell some stories about some of the books he's dealt with, and then we'll open it up for questions.
There's a book that came out a few years ago. It was very popular among book collectors. It was called A Gentle Madness. And in it, it talks about the bibliophile and the bibliomane, and that one's the master and one's the slave. The question is, what are you? Part of Brian's paper was going to discuss a term called hypermodern. In the real world, the real book collecting world, a traditional book such as Harper's To Kill a Mockingbird, that book traditionally increases in value very slowly, and is sort of a static rate all the time. Or almost any dealer can say, "Oh, it's $500 an hour," or it's $550 an hour. As of just recently, it's gone up to nearly $2,000 because of the internet. But it's sort of a standard, slowly increasing in value. Everybody knows what it is, and it's just kind of a known thing. Well, in the hypermodern world, what hypermodern means is books have been published within the past 10 to 15 years. A good example of a hypermodern book in the Mormon arena would have been Mike Quinn's Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. As soon as the first print run was finished, the book originally sold for $14.95. It immediately started to increase in value. And when I was the rare book buyer for Benchmark Books, we would very, very commonly sell the book for $100, and there was other dealers that were selling them for sometimes even $300. Now, let me ask you a question real quick. How do you find the value of a book? What's the value of a book? How do you determine the value of a book? Okay, supply and demand. Okay, the demand for Mike Quinn's book was huge. Now, if you remember, not too long ago, the book was reprinted. You can buy paperback copies, brand new, in the store for $20. If you go down to Kurtz, you might be able to talk him out of one of the signed ones he has in the back. As soon as the book came back into print, you started seeing people dump them on the internet. And the hardbacks, beautiful hardback first editions with dust jackets, were plummeting down to $40 and $45. I think the last one that we sold at Kurt's shop on the internet, that's opening it up to everybody. The highest bidder takes it. I think it went for $45. So the problem with hypermodern books is that the value of the book fluctuates. It goes up and then it goes down, and because there's no real set established price of the book, for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, or 100 years, you never know where the book's going to go. And a small thing like the book coming back into print could crash the value of the book. Or someone who's secretly kept back, you know, hordes of them, and slowly starts letting them out. You know, if a book only has two or three requests at a used bookstore, and you suddenly give that bookstore five copies, you know, the value is going to start crashing. Well, let me give you some examples of this. Francis Gibbons has done a series of books on the life of each of the prophets, beginning with Joseph Smith, and the last one, I believe, was President Benson. Well, if you go to Benchmark Books, you'll find that the longest waiting list for any book that he has in the shop, the number one longest waiting list is Lorenzo Snow by Francis Gibbons. The book is okay. It's really sort of more of a popular read, but he has over 200 requests for that book. And talking about supply and demand, the book sells for $75 to $100. But if you jump on Kurt's waiting list for it, you're going to be on there for 20 years. That's how long it would take for him to find 200 copies, literally. Okay. Well, he had a book. Many of Gibbons' books are like this. The average waiting list for the hard ones is about 4 to 5 years. As of recently, Brigham Young was one of the very more difficult ones. It was about a four-year wait. It was a $50 book. We had, at Benchmark, we had about 60 people on the waiting list. Well, it came back into print, and I believe they only did about 1,000 copies. And so I immediately ordered, you know, X amount for the store. I believe out of the 50 or 60 requests that we had, we sold about 20 copies, and now you can't give away, you know, the used copies because the market is so saturated. And that's what I think Brian was trying to talk about, is that, you know, with the hypermodern books in the real world of fiction and histories and biography, that the values of the books will fluctuate depending on supply and demand and what's going on in the market. Well, in the Mormon market, the same thing is sort of happening, but in a microcosm. There was a book that came out 4 or 5 years ago that would just sit on the shelf. It was called Other Eminent Men of Wilford Woodruff by an author by the name of Anderson. When I worked at Deseret Book, I saw maybe two or three copies leave the shop the whole time I was with them. Well, suddenly the book just disappeared. Supply dried up, and the book immediately climbed to $50. It was a $16 book. And then Kurt's waiting list went from, you know, 4 or 5 copies up to 20 copies, and then when I left Benchmark, I think there was about 50 to 70 requests for the book, which means that the premium for the book, supply and demand, was pushing the book up in the $75 range. The book just came back into print a few weeks ago, and so all the values just crashing. So that's sort of the idea that Brian was trying to talk about. You know, some of the books that are done, sometimes they're just small private print runs of the books, and once word gets around about them and that they would be interesting, the books will increase in value. And some books or some series, because institutions have spent great time and money and energy to put them together, there's no way to reproduce them, such as the reproduction set of the Book of Mormons that that Greg was talking about. You know, there's no way to reproduce those, so those volumes are just going to go nuts. But so anyway, I think that's what Brian was really trying to talk about. He wanted to talk about some specifics, and I know that he had a slideshow, and it's unfortunate that he's here. But I guess at this time, I'm happy to answer any questions. As a rare book buyer for Kurt, the advantage of working for Kurt Bench at Benchmark Books was that we kept a want list of all the books that that people requested. And so if a person requested a book 18 years prior, we still kept the request card until we found the book. And so we had literally tens of thousands of requests for books. And so it helped you to understand, you know, what books were becoming hot, what books were slowing down, and that sort of thing. So anyway. Well, I mean, always you want to collect the books that you enjoy. That's the catchphrase that Kurt would say. Personally, if it was me, I would try and do a little research. I would try and find out what publishers are printing, how much they print. A good, as you know, Gary, a good, solid Mormon history, such as Todd Compton's book, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Todd Compton's book on Joseph Smith and the plural wives of Joseph Smith, I believe the first print run was 2000, and the book sold out in 3 weeks. Boom. you know, so first thing I did is I went and bought three copies, and I stashed them away, first editions. It came back into print, and I don't know how many has been printed since, probably 1,500, 2,000, and they're really slowly going out now. If you were to be really serious about collecting, you'd want to find out what kind of numbers were printed, get an idea what the market will bear, and find out if there's going to be reprints and so on and so forth. The first Todd Compton book still sells. It originally came out at $40. It's about a $60 book now. And it's going to, if the book ever were to ever go out of print and it was not to come back into print, the book would go nuts because it's very popular.
One of the things that I'd want to clarify, Gary, is why do you want to collect? I mean, are you collecting because you want to have a good research library? Is this a substitute for the stock market for you? And there are some people who are in book collecting as a substitute for the stock market, kind of a thing. So, Tom has kind of addressed, you know, if you want a good, sound research library and maybe, you know, say to appreciate and value, if you're going to look at it from strictly an investment perspective, I would say the thing to consider there is the wow factor for the home teachers. That's kind of the rule of thumb I see. You know, if you look what has happened in book prices over the last 10 years, the ones that impress, you know, the person who sits next to you in gospel doctrine are the ones that have really shot up in value. I mean, back in the early 90s, we were buying and selling first edition Book of Mormons for right around $10,000 for a nice copy. Today, that same book trades hands at $75,000. But if you were to look, for example, at a much rarer book, say, and this is one Tom and I were just talking about the other day, the first edition Danish Doctrine and Covenants, okay? I mean, those the known copies of that are less than 30, okay? Whereas there have probably been 30 first edition Book of Mormons that have traded hands in the last 2 months, kind of a thing. But that Danish DNC, that first edition Danish DNC, we bought and sold that in the beginning of the 90s for $500 to $700. If you walked up to me today with one, I'd pay you maybe $700-$800. Because the collector's market, you know, the first edition foreign language Book of Mormon, you wipe out a good 95% of the book collectors when you go non-English, okay? You get beyond the Book of Mormon and you wipe out 95% of that 5%. So, you know, you don't see the same price appreciation because, you know, that supply and demand Tom was talking about, there isn't the demand even though the supply is virtually non-existent. I've got in my personal collection numerous foreign language imprints, pamphlets, broadsides, etc., that in many instances it's a unique copy or the only other known copy is in the church archives or at BYU, and yet to look at that as a retirement fund is insane because outside of the church or BYU, nobody really cares. So, do you have a question? Yeah.
Right. Right. It was on page 145. sorry. Edgar Guest is a very popular. President Benson loved Edgar Guest. You'd see copies that he would give away that he'd sign, and I think Heber J. Grant loved Guest and would hand out copies of his books of poetry. And it's kind of odd. In Father Featherstone's book, it just basically said, "Here I sit with my pipe and book, you know, in front of the fireplace." I can't quote the poem. But, you know, it's a beautiful, innocuous statement by Edgar Guest. Suddenly you see the next state of the book comes out, and you can physically open the book, and you can see that page is shorter than the rest of the pages in the book, because what they did is they went through and they took all the copies, they tore out that page, and they tipped in a new page, and they put, and the new quote says, "Here I sit with my ellipse book in my favorite chair," you know, blah 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 blah. They took out the whole reference to pipe, and then in the next edition, all it is the ellipse. You don't have the pages pulled out. So there's three states of the book. There's the original state, the state with the page cut out, and then the new edition with the it printed right in normally. So, yeah, I mean.
Well, my question about that is, you know, like the David Holden Kimball and stuff like that.
Those are the things that make the things collectible. I mean, sometimes they can artificially be made like that, but that's something that where a decision was made and it makes the book collectible. Once again, supply and demand. You're probably the first people outside of a small group of people that I'm aware of that has been told that story. And so, once again, demand, the story isn't known, people aren't aware of it, and the collectors in general aren't even aware of that existing. And so, until there's more of a larger audience aware of what had happened and that little story, the value of that book's not going to come up, of course, but as now the people are starting to hear about the story, the book will start to appreciate in value, and everybody will be checking that page 145.
So go along. Yeah. On the comment, just really quick, on the comment about some of these things seeming really bizarre, I guess in defense of Deseret Book Management, and if any of them ever listen to this tape, they'll be stunned I would do this, but in defense of Deseret Book Management, they really have an impossible job. I mean, the layperson views everything they put out, everything they sell, as having some sort of imprimatur from the church, which it really doesn't, and that's why they're put in the position they're in. In fact, to give you an idea of some of the hassle that they go through, you've probably seen or been given somewhere along the way a pamphlet by Marvin J. Ashton called "One for the Money." And in there he talks about family budgeting and taking care of yourself. Well, several years ago there was an individual who took upon himself to criticize Deseret Management as to the types of books they stocked in their regular fiction. And the author this guy really liked to hammer away at was Ken Follett. And he'd pick a book, Eye of the Needle, and he'd say, "Look at this in the book, and look at that in the book." Well, he actually went out and he published a pamphlet entitled "Just for the Money." And it was, and the cover looks identical to "One for the Money" by Marvin J. Ashton, who at that point in time was on the board of Deseret Book. And he went through and he would give examples of books that he had bought at Deseret Book and what he deemed to be pornography that was in these books. And granted, some of the things that go on in a Ken Follett novel aren't appropriate to a gospel doctrine discussion, but that's not the intent of a book. It's to sit on a lounge chair next to a beach and, get sunbaked. That's the intent of that book. So Deseret Book does have, in many ways, an impossible job to do. And so the most bizarre stories naturally come out of an environment where that is existing.
Just once again, supply and demand. If there's a book, I mean, there's a book by Dwayne Crowther called Prophecy. I mean, at any day, 24/7, you can walk into any DI and you can find one for $2. Okay, so, and yet they're still printing them, which makes no sense. So, if the supply gets bigger, the demand gets bigger, that'll usually promote someone to say, "Hey, bright idea. Let's do that." It hurts. In my personal collection, you have to understand, bibliomane, okay, slave. there's a book that I really want to have, I will buy a nice volume of it, but I would never open it. I'll buy another book and I'll read it. But the underlining damages it. A lot of people take the dust jackets, toss that. In the real world, the dust jacket's 80% of the value of the book. Mormon market, because there are people, most people are like you that want the book for the information. It's not quite so that the impact isn't so great. But still, a first edition Mormon doctrine, the dust jacket is worth probably several hundred dollars, just the dust jacket by itself. Give you an example in the real world, Orson Scott Card, one of my favorite authors, Ender's Game by him, the first edition, it's an $850 book. Toss the jacket, you got a $50 reading copy, maybe even a $25 reading copy. That's how important the dust jackets are. So condition, you know, on dog-eared pages, underlining, all that obviously would detract from the value of the book.
Well, and just to show you how bizarre collectors are on the underlining issue, there's an email list called LDS Bookshelf where goofballs like Tom and I hang out and swap stories and trade books and, you know, get in fights and all that kind of stuff. One of the new members to the list raised this very question about, you know, is it okay to underline my books, which, of course, brought forth a barrage of, you idiot, you know, why would you ever do that, that kind of stuff. The most telling email came from a friend of Tom and I's who will leave his name anonymous, but his email read, and this is an exact quote to the best of my memory, the only book that I underline are my scriptures. The rest are just too valuable.
Now, if you underline your book and your name is David O. McKay, I mean, then the value obviously would come up.
Sure.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, to immediate family members, marginalia is of great interest. To the collector, unless there's some significance to the association, grandpa's margin notes are going to detract from the value.
Did you know there was a word for that, marginalia? That was a new one for me. It's pretty bad, huh?
Another trend that just occurred to me that is going on in Mormon collecting that's a little bit bizarre has been in this same hyper-modern thing, and it's been producing extremely small leather-bound editions of books. And there have been some bookshops that have actually gone to the they've ordered 30 copies from the publisher, ripped the covers off, put leather bindings on them, and then priced them at $200 to $300, and have sold them. That trend kind of started what, 3-4 years ago?
No, it's a couple years ago.
I mean, once that word kind of got out, there was a big discussion on this LDS bookshelf about how these really weren't true states of the book because they aren't being produced by the publisher. It'd be no different than one of us just, you know, going over, buying 30 copies, ripping them off, rebinding them. I mean, that's not a true state of the book. So in the opinion of most on the bookshelf, it was not a true collectible. But the fetish for this leather bound has not been satiated by any stretch of the imagination. Back in 1978, the University of Utah put out a bibliography of Mormon imprints, put together by Chad Flake, who was the head of BYU's rare book thing. Chad's now retired, although he shows up every day at the library down at BYU anyway. But this book had over 10,000 entries, and it's kind of the Bible of Mormon booksellers, Mormon collectors. Well, the book is out of print, and a nice copy now sells for $600, $700, $800. There was a bookshop outside of the Salt Lake County area that all of a sudden began selling leather-bound copies. And stories flew through the collector world that apparently originated with the fellow selling these books, that Chad Flake had saved some of these. Another version was University of Utah had magically found this undiscovered box and had sold them to Barnes & Noble, and then they'd been bought by Barnes & Noble. Well, once we got to the bottom of it, really what had happened is this guy had been buying photocopies from UMI, University of Michigan, and he'd been binding them in leather. So we discuss on bookshelf about how really you've bought, you know, the guy was pricing them at $1,500. Leather-bound photocopies. And so we were all joking around on the list about, you know, the idiocy in doing this. And one of the fellows that everybody knows had bought this came back with the response, "But it's a beautiful book!" So, you know, I mean, those kind of books I don't think are going to go anywhere in value. These manufactured
leather bounds that are not a true state of the book. It's got to be a true state of the book, in my opinion, to really go anywhere and have any value.
There's also a term in the book world is called ephemeral. There would be pieces of ephemera with regards to books or people or whatever. And a dust jacket is considered ephemeral. Ephemera means short-lasting, and so it's meant to be tossed, you know, or not to be. It's meant to protect the book itself. And it's the ephemeral aspects of many books that make them valuable, or the original state of the book, and the most original. Sometimes you'll see books that come in that are printed in the 1800s. They still have the original publisher's wrap around the book, and it's the wrap that makes it valuable as opposed to the book itself. It's just.
Well, and that ephemeral stuff, you know, really is a true collectible item, as bizarre as it sounds. On February 29th of this year, the Church Printing Center deemed that was the day that they would most likely be printing the 100 millionth copy of the Book of Mormon. So at the end of the day, they had a little kind of get-together for the employees there at the Church Printing Center. They had taken copies of the Book of Mormon that they had run that day, and they'd put in the front cover a little presentation plate. There was a special full-color bookmark that they printed up, and then there was a little folded sheet explaining, in about four paragraphs, a brief publishing history of the Book of Mormon. And they presented that to each employee of the Church Printing Center that was there that day. I interact quite frequently with the church historian's office, you know, showing them stuff I've found, they show me stuff they've found, you know, we commiserate on how these greedy people are destroying the market by pushing the prices up on us and stuff like that. Well, the church historian's office had worked intimately with the Church Printing Center to create this full-color bookmark. On one side, there was an illustration, you know, kind of an artist interpretation of a publishing history of the Book of Mormon, and then on the back of it, there were 10 different pictures of different editions of the Book of Mormon in full color, and they'd gone over and taken pictures of that at the historian's office. Well, I have 7 copies of the 100 millionth printing of the Book of Mormon, each one of them stamped 100 millionth copy, kind of a thing, with all of the ephemeral stuff I just described in there. The historian's office didn't get any of that. In fact, they didn't know anything existed beyond the bookmark until I showed it to them. Then they made a formal request, and the printing center sent them over a copy that was stamped 100 millionth, and then they said, well, you know, where's the plate? And so they sent them over a plate, and then they said, well, where's the little sheet with the publishing history? And they said, well, we don't have any more of those. So I had to donate a copy so the historical office would at least have it. But little ephemeral stuff like that, I mean, it's not made with the intention to be collected, but stuff like that is really going to go up in value, you know, for odd people like Tom and I, kind of a thing. So,
yes, please.
Are either of you aware of any copies of the first state that might be in the same-sex dynamics
book? I'm aware of 2 of them. Maybe 3. Anyway, thank you. Anybody else? Thank you.
Let's thank our 2 presenters for filling in today.